Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Living in the Light and our continued discussion of Swamiji's words in the little pamphlet, A New Dispensation. So let's begin with a prayer. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Master Paramhansa Yogananda, Saints of all religions, dearest friend Swami Kriyananda, humbly we bow to you all. Help us to open our hearts without any fear or reservation. Help us always to know that you love us unconditionally. And whatever you ask of us, whatever you bring to us, is always to bring us closer to your heart, to bring us closer to our own reality of perfect love and perfect bliss. We are your children. Mother, care for us always. Om. Peace. Amen. Okay, friends, so here we go. We are still in the section called A Way Out, and it's a way out of delusion is what we're working with. And we are talking about divine grace. Am I correct on this? Yes. Yes, that's where we are. So now Swami continues talking about, we were talking yesterday about Ariadne's thread and how complicated the mind is, and I was just giving examples of how incredibly confused we get. There was one other that was really my favorite, which I forgot to mention yesterday. I'll just say it today. This was an actual real experience. There was a period of time when we lived in Ananda Village when some of us would go in and play racquetball at the local health club. It was just a little fad that lasted a while. It was fun. And I was there in the hot tub, which was kind of collective, everybody. There was just one for the whole club. And there was a youngish girl, maybe 10, and her mother was there. And they were not members of Ananda. They were just local townspeople. And we were just chatting, as people do, about in hot tubs, because it's a weirdly intimate situation for strangers. And we were talking about what we were doing, because that was all we had in common. And so the woman said, you know, a hot tub is all right, but I prefer the dry heat of a sauna. And her little girl, who just had the same consciousness as her mother, you could just see it, just looked at her mother and said, I prefer the dry heat of a sauna too, like that. And I just, in that moment, and this part of it is projection, not true, but in that moment, I just saw this little girl growing up, because she looked like she was going to grow up just like her mother. She was growing up just like her mother. And this would always be a point of view. I prefer the dry heat of a sauna. And her husband would say, let's put in a hot tub. You know I don't like hot tubs. You know I prefer the dry heat of a sauna. You know, and you could just see this whole life based on just this random moment when the little girl wanted to be like her mother. And you multiply that by millions of lifetimes. And that's why the only way out is grace. And that's why Swami calls it the way out. Because we can't untie all of these crazy knots. We can't learn what every turn, everyone is a dead end, and then we make a note, and then we know that this one is a dead end and that one is a dead end. What happens is, by the power of grace, we shift the level of consciousness. And so when it's like being transported to the top of the hill, and then you can just look down and you see that all of them were byways, that there was only one way up. And that was basically the hand of God reaching down to us. And that's what it feels like. And that's what Swami's really talking about. He's talking about the divine truth of it. And that's what this whole pamphlet is about, is that there is a ray of grace. And everything else we do is just a means to putting us in tune with that. And the more consciously we recognize that, and the more consciously we devote ourselves to the real main event, which is to be in tune, the easier we will progress. So anyway, Swami writes, Divine grace, again, like electricity, flows through channels. As electricity is passed on through transmitting stations, so also is grace through the attunement of living persons. In one of the most fascinating, this is another aspect that Swami's putting in here, which is, and this goes back to, those who try, who seek attunement with others who are more advanced than they are in the on the path, advance more than those who don't. Because what we're talking about here is, yes, the master is the guiding force. Yes, he's the origin point of all the power. But that power is also transmitted through those who are in tune with him. So those who seek attunement with those who are in tune are opening themselves up in a more powerful way and actually cooperating with divine law. In one of the most fascinating passages of his autobiography, Paramhansa Yogananda wrote, "Thoughts are universally and not individually rooted." That's on page 159 of the book. His statement is deceptively simple. Let us probe it more deeply by means of a visualization exercise. Imagine mighty rivers of consciousness flowing through the universe. So let's just think about, you know, outer space as we've seen it. And there's mighty rivers of consciousness flowing, sweeping through vast stellar systems, engulfing planets, catching up in swirling currents, the little thoughts, ideas, and passions of men. So you see a planet, and you see a river of consciousness, and all the human beings are getting swept up in that river. In various lands of Earth, and at various times through the course of history, one cosmic river or another will touch human lives, perhaps changing thereby the very course of history. In various lands on Earth, all these different countries, at different times through history, one cosmic river or another will touch human lives, perhaps changing thereby the very course of history. Think of the Italian artistic Renaissance. Think of the Communist Revolution in Russia. Think of the rise of America of the USA and the revolution, the War of Independence. Think of the rise of Nazism in Germany. Think of the many different changes that the country of China has been through, the Cultural Revolution in China, among other things that have happened. Men imagine that it is they who create history. As well might the little leaf bobbing lightly on the water surface think to determine the river's course. That's a really wonderful image to think of. I'm sure all of us have seen a leaf floating down a river, and you can see how powerful the river is and how insignificant the leaf is, but the leaf could imagine, you know, look how fast I'm moving. Look, I will to move fast, and now I'm moving fast. Swami jokes about a friend of his. He took a European friend. He took to Disneyland with his family, and they went on a little boat ride, and you had the steering wheel. You had the illusion that you were steering, but the boats were actually on tracks underneath, but they zigged and zagged a little bit, so it wasn't just like a straight line, so you really had the feeling that somehow you were related to it. And Swami was trying to talk across from boat to boat to his friend, but he had his children in the boat, and he didn't want to be distracted from keeping his boat. You know, and afterwards, they teased him a great deal. But that's how we are in life. We think that our destiny, that we as men and women, are actually determining our destiny, and we don't understand that we're on this cosmic track of energy. And that cosmic track is so enormous compared to us, that a little leaf floating on the wind, on the river, is exactly what it is. And the arrogance of the leaf to think it's determining the river's course. Free will does indeed exist, but not as most people imagine it. Not, that is to say, in private, egoic isolation from the universe. See, that's how we think of free will, is that I can just do whatever I want, When we don't think that through carefully, we don't realize the extent to which everything about us is already predetermined. We find ourselves in a particular body. I mean, we can surgically intervene and shift that body, but even the presence of surgical intervention is itself a condition that was placed in front of us that made us an option. We have a culture, we have hair color, we have eye color, we have a language, a first language that we speak, we have biological relationships with other human beings. Where did all of this come from? And where do you cut it? Where can you take any piece, any one of those influences, and just cut it out like with scissors and separate it? I mean, you can just think about it. Who your parents are, how they came together to conceive you, who conceived them, how did they meet each other, why was there an affinity between them, and you're pretty soon everything, which is the truth, is interconnected. So how do I make free will in the midst of this? Even the things that I want to exercise my free will on are compelled by some previous conditioning. It could be very depressing, except that the power behind it is the powerful love of God. That's what makes it not depressing. So free will does indeed exist, but not as most people imagine it. Not, that is to say, in private, egoic isolation from the universe. Freedom must be sought, rather, in broader realities than just the individual ego. Man is free only in the sense that he can choose his influences. Each one can determine which, out of an infinity of streams of universal consciousness, he will enter. That's just, you think about that for a moment. There's an infinity of streams of universal consciousness. Some of them will inspire you to write music. Some will inspire you to become an engineer. Some will inspire you to become a drug addict. Some will inspire you to go off and live a natural life out in the country. These are infinite threads of possibility. Some will lead you to autobiography of a yogi and will cause you to feel that is a true book. Some will lead you to the Catholic Church or to emigrate to Israel so that you can carry on the destiny of the Jewish people. But all of these, you see, are, if you stand back from it, you see that they're vibrations of consciousness and they're forces in the universe, and they will influence us and take us in a certain direction. So our freedom is to be able to stand back and say, you know, which stream of consciousness do I wish to attune myself to? Because I'm a leaf on the river. And when I enter that stream of consciousness, I have the capacity then to ride that current to wherever it's going. So where is it going? See, this is the folly that people, especially it's characteristic of young people, but it can be quite as common among older people, that we just insist that I can do whatever I want, that this current is not going to take me to its obvious destination. That's how people get into addictions. It's obvious where this is taking me, but I'm pretending it's not. I've aligned myself with this stream of consciousness and I can see the end point of it, but I'm going to pretend it's not true. I'm pretending that I still have free will and I'm making my own decisions. We see it all around us, but the unfortunate results of it are self-evident. So each one can determine which, out of an infinity of streams of universal consciousness, he will enter. The rivers of history are extraordinarily powerful. The great majority of men and women, failing to tune into them consciously, are swept helplessly hither and yon by the merest ripples. My parents and I never were in tune on the level of spiritual philosophy. So I never really had, I was never able to have any actual real philosophical conversations with them because it just wasn't their inclination. But when my mother was toward the end of her life, and I became very involved with them again in the last years of their lives, even though I left home when I was 18, but they needed care at the end. And because death was going to be the end of the story that we were on at that point, the plot line was leading to death, I said to my mother one day, you know, how do you feel about death? Are you afraid? And she said, no, which I think she wasn't. It was very sweet. She said, no. But it, as it happened, I believe it was a presidential election year, if I'm not mistaken. But there was some interesting American politics happening at that time. And my mother sort of said, no, I'm not afraid of dying. But then she said like this, but I hate to think of all of this going on and me not being here to be part of it. I thought, well, that is a way to think about it, isn't it? And I knew at the time she was referring to the politics and the interesting national developments and all that. It was a river, a current of the river that she was always really interested in following. Nowadays, many people in the U.S. are quite concerned about national politics and the way things are developing, and many people are leaves on that particular current, and they feel that their destiny is being determined by these historical forces, and they're caught up and they're tuned into it and committed to it as a reality. It's not that it isn't a reality, but it's one that we can tune ourselves into, and it's one that we have to decide whether or not it's really the defining force of our lives. And these are the questions we have to ask. So he says the rivers of history are powerful, and the great majority of people failing to tune into them consciously are swept helplessly hither and yon by the merest ripples. Good news today, bad news tomorrow. Geniuses, on the other hand, may, and saints invariably do, flow serenely and joyously with the flood until they reach the ocean of cosmic consciousness and freedom from all bondage. See, what exactly is he saying? The rivers of history are powerful. Oh, that they're not tossed helplessly about, that geniuses, and they hold their own center in the midst of the river. Ordinary man, yes, here it is, a genius focuses on what he's trying to accomplish, whether it's artistic or engineering or scientific or whatever he might do. He just focuses on exactly what he's doing. Steve Jobs was legendary in the Silicon Valley, where I live, and really in the whole world, for his absolute capacity to live outside of what was going on, but to see where he wanted to go and how others would go with him. When people would talk to him about market research or asking what people wanted, he said, they don't know what they want because I haven't invented it yet. And it sounded arrogant, but it was just the truth. I haven't invented it yet. I will invent it, and then they will want it. And that's the genius level that moves with its own reality. I mean, even just in small things, when he was choosing colors for one of his products, people wanted him to sort of test different colors, and he absolutely refused to, because he said here, ordinary man is caught up in fads of the moment, and he drifts passively more often than not into stagnant bywaters from which death alone rescues him at last. Swami never minces words. He moves passively into stagnant bywaters from which death alone rescues him at last, instead of the freedom claimed by him as his inalienable human right. He achieves mere bondage to outwardness and to ego. See, this is what Swami's talking about. People, there's the flow of society, this is what he's talking, the flow of history is extraordinarily strong. Society is just going in a certain way. And people just go with the river, the leaf, and they think that they're running their own life, but they're just flowing along, and it usually leads to nowhere. I saw some little posting on social media the other day, and it's, I don't know who she is, but some very, very famous model has cancer and either has died or is about to die. A woman, and she wrote some kind of a farewell letter to people. It was not as profound as it could have been, but it was very profound for what it was. She just wrote about all the things she had, all the money, all the success, all the adulation, all the glamorous lifestyle, just everything. And none of it mattered, because the only thing that mattered was death. And she didn't finish the story about how you should live, but she was reminding people it didn't matter how many expensive shoes she had in her closet. When death comes for you, death comes for you, just like that. In other words, she was beginning to realize that she didn't have egoic free will, private egoic free will, that she could just carve out her place and she was going to be able to go where she wanted to go. I mean, the fundamental river that we're all riding is the river between birth and death, just like that. So he says, most people just end up sort of nowhere because they haven't chosen their influences. And this is what Swami is encouraging us. Those, however, who attune themselves to the great streams of consciousness achieve greatness themselves. This is true genius. It is even truer of spiritual greatness. As the Bible puts it, as many as received him, to them gave he the power to become the sons of God. So what Swamiji is talking about here is that we are all influenced by one of these infinite streams of consciousness. And if we just ride whatever's going on around us, you know, pick up our values from the world around us, have our expectations based on what's going on around us, we'll just end up wherever that river leads us, which is usually not anywhere in particular. That's where he praises some stagnant bywater from which death alone can rescue you, where you just set up your little life, wherever it might be. But he said, true geniuses and all saints, you know, find that cosmic ray that is leading us not just into stagnant bywaters in the end of the body, but actually is taking us through all of this other chaos into the ocean of bliss. But it's a conscious choice of attunement. That's what this whole thing is about. Into this valley of the shadow of death, earth's sorrowful realm, God, from time to time, through the agency of one of his awakened sons, sends the ray of light that I have described. Many are the rays that he has sent throughout history. Now Swami's talking about the avatars, the descent of the great masters. Ever and again, through your awakened sons, the answer comes. That's what we say in the Festival of Light every week. We reach the point in our own lives, we say, what is real? Everything that I thought was light was but darkness. Who am I in reality? For what end was I made? Lifetime after lifetime, we just enter into the world as it's given to us. We float down that river, we end up where we are. One of the vivid feeling memories of my life before I met Swami, and this would have been sort of in my 15, 16 years old, when I was sort of an age where I wasn't a little child anymore, and I could I was seeing that I was going to have to make choices. You know, what kind of college would I go to? Would I go to graduate school? Would I become a lawyer? Would I become a doctor? Just whatever the careers that were open to a person who was school smart, because I was school smart. I didn't have other talents, but I was good at school. So it was all the kinds of things you would do after 14 years of academia or whatever it was. And I feel it. I can still feel what it felt like. Every one of those roads, and there was nothing, you know, there was nothing evil about them, but every one of them, it was like there I was as a teenager and I was standing there and I knew I could walk it. I didn't have doubt in my mind that I couldn't do the work, that I wasn't capable, that I couldn't be successful at a career, whatever it might be. But it was like I was standing at the beginning of that cycle. I could see the end of it. I wasn't spiritually minded. I was a truth seeker. I wasn't a devotee yet, but I was a truth seeker. And I could feel the end of it. I could feel, it's interesting when I talk about it now, because it's like when I'm going back into experience I had as a teenager, and I'm having the experience when I speak of it. I could see the end of it. It was like a deathbed scene is what I would see. There I was. I was a professor in some field or another, and there I was on my deathbed. I had been an attorney, and there I was on my deathbed. I was a politician, and there I was on my deathbed. I was a doctor. There I was on my deathbed. It wasn't like any of the intervening life was ugly or unpleasant. It's just it would end, and the life would end, and I wouldn't have anything I really wanted. I could just tell that none of those rivers were going to give me what I wanted. And I was paralyzed because I knew what I didn't want, but it wasn't until 6 years later, or actually just 3 years later, when met Vivekananda's books, and then a few years later met Swami. Oh, this is the river that I want. This is exactly the river that I want. And from that, from the age of 19, when I found it, I just gripped it. I knew this was the river. And there were all the other ones still pulling. You know, you could do this, you could do that. Why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? No, this is the one, because this is going somewhere that I really want to go. And of course, I met Swami, I became a disciple of Master, all those things happened. And the refinement of how you actually do that has been a 50-year practice, which is as fresh and interesting today as it was the very first day I started, because until we're at infinity, we're busy. We're very busy trying to attune ourselves ever more deeply to this river. But it's not one of fads. It's not one of historical civilizations that rise and fall. I mean, those are very powerful forces, but all those rivers lead someplace that I don't want to go. Well, the actual word is that wonderful slang. Swami did not really care much for slang, but he liked this one. Been there, done that. That really just says it, doesn't it? That's when I look back at my 16-year-old self. Been there, done that. Isn't there, you know, is there somebody else I can talk to? Is there some other way that we can solve this? So Swami says, you know, into this dark world of confusion, from time to time, God sends one of his awakened sons. And a ray of light, that's what I've described, that's what Swami is, this ray of grace. Many are the rays that he has sent throughout history. Salvation is achieved by those who, recognizing their own affinity with one such ray, attune themselves to it and allow it to lead them out of darkness into the infinite light. Isn't that just the most beautiful thing in the world to think about? Ever and again, through our awakened sons, the answer comes. And every so often into this valley of the shadow of death, which is this human life that we all have to live, where there's a lot of suffering and everything is temporary, there's one of these awakened sons. And then one feels an affinity with one of them. I mean, that word affinity is such a sweet word. You feel that somehow this one resonates with me. And I mean, you've all heard my intuitive response when I saw Swamiji was that what he is what I'm trying to be. And it was so vivid because at that point I had been reading about it. I'd been reading about it for a long time. I actually was going to East West Bookshop, which was not owned by Ananda at that time, but by someone else. There was no internet. And bookstores, especially these small metaphysical bookstores, of which I was very fortunate to live quite near one of the best in the country. And I would go in and I was reading the biographies of saints. I was just like going through the section. I was reading about Himalayan yogis and Milarepa in Tibet and St. Francis and St. Teresa and different great yogis. I was trying to figure out how you do it. Because I knew it was there to be done, but I didn't know how you would do it. And I felt an affinity with Ramakrishna, and I would go to his temple in San Francisco or in Los Angeles when I was there, and I met some of those swamis. But that, even though I felt very powerfully attuned to Ramakrishna, and I still do, none of the swamis ever spoke to me in any way that, even in retrospect, it's like, the affinity was so non-existent that it never crossed my mind to pursue any actual relationship with any of them. It never even entered my consciousness. But the moment I saw Swami Kriyananda, literally, that was it. And that's what happens to us. Now, for other people, they pick up Autobiography of a Yogi. Or for others, they walk into the Ananda temple, and this happens. Or they walk onto the grounds of the Ananda retreat. Often they'll come for another purpose. But they'll feel something there. And they won't even necessarily know what it is. But they'll feel something, and that feels like it belongs to them. And those who have the courage and the good karma and the imagination and the willpower will then begin to separate themselves out from whatever river of consciousness in this vast universe they've been floating on for all that time, and will begin to try to choose to attune to this one. And that's the whole spiritual path. That's what Swami's trying to teach us here. So, my friends, thank you, and we'll see you tomorrow.